Ryan Tanner will inbound. He gets it over to the doctor. Tie ball game. Here's a shot. Julius. He scores! He scores at the buzzer, and the Nets win 120 to 118.
I think we see Willis coming out.
Here comes Willis.
Carter, over to Kidd, baseline drive, Kidd throws it up, oh! How did he do it?
Randall on the drive, stripped by Butler, Randall gets it back, Randall puts up a three, bang, bang, Randall knocks down the three with 0.7 seconds remaining.
With full court press coverage on all of the signings, trades, big games, and everything Knicks, Nets, and across the association, this is Pick and Pod on WFUV Sports.
What's up, everybody, and welcome into another edition of Pick and Pod, WFUV Sports NBA podcast, along with Evan Harkin and Miles Grossman. I'm Colin Lochran, happy to be with you. Guys, it's playoff time. We're in the first round of the NBA playoffs. The Knicks are hot. The Celtics, a little concerning with their loss to the Miami Heat last night. A ton to get to today. It really is the most wonderful time on the NBA calendar, Miles.
It really is. This Philadelphia-New York series has given us everything and more. I've never seen a team down 2-0 with this kind of likelihood to come back. I mean, it really seems like they have a chance. In it down the stretch last game, I know this is a Knicks podcast, this is a Knicks city. In my mind, Philadelphia deserved to win that game. Obviously, a pretty historic crumble, but going back to Philadelphia outside of MSG, that's not getting talked about enough. MSG is like a whole six man on the court. Now, Colin, I know that's a compliment to MSG fans, but when you go into Philadelphia, it's going to get a heck of a lot tougher. And that's why I do see the Knicks probably eking this one out, but it's not going four. It's not going four at all.
Evan, enough with this guy. How is your week going so far?
Yeah, like you guys said, I mean, just the best time in sports. So I'm having a great week because there's always a playoff game I could watch. I was at the Yankee game yesterday watching basketball on one phone, a hockey on the phone next to me. It doesn't get better than this time right now, so super excited to talk Knicks. Finally something good maybe to say about the Nets. Couldn't say that the whole season probably, so
Nets finally found a head coach. We'll touch on that as well. And Evan, you've been a busy man. You've been doing fantastic work as the Mets beat reporter. Baseball, of course, still hot in this town as well with how well the Mets and Yankees have been performing lately. But we do have to start on 33rd Street, and the New York Knicks won a hell of a game too against the Philadelphia 76ers, 104 to 101. It came down to the wire. And as someone who was blessed to be in that building, I don't know if I've ever seen Madison Square Garden explode the way it exploded after Dante DiVincenzo hit the big shot to put the Knicks up 102 to 101. And after that, it was a matter of free throws and time. But Miles, of course, you have to acknowledge the day after the game, it was reported that the Knicks were benefited by some calls from the refs in the full review. You have to acknowledge that. Joel Embiid, of course, after the game, his head in the towel. We're the better team. We should be up 2-0. All this nonsense. And upon thinking about it, I realize, and I say this as someone who's covered this team, I say this as a New Yorker, the calls, the fact that Philly is probably, big air quotes, the more talented team, doesn't matter because you didn't win either game. You got blown out in game one at Madison Square Garden. We hear all this nonsense about, oh, Philly's tough, blue-collar city. You didn't play like it in game one. And then game two, did you see Tyrese Maxey try to hold the ball on the last play? Did you see him get bullied by Deuce McBride, of all people, earlier in the game, who just kind of shoved him out of the way? What's blue-collared about that? So, yeah, the Knicks didn't play a neat game down the stretch. It wasn't a neat game. This is not a neat Knicks team. They're not going to go up to you and be like, okay, take that three-pointer. They're not the Celtics. They're not the Miami Heat. They're not playing this spacing style of current NBA basketball. And it's refreshing to see because they give a damn about the outcome. You can't say that about every NBA player on every NBA team. And I know it's become so in vogue to have the opinion that these guys are professional athletes. It's a job. They don't have to care 24/7. The Knicks, for me at least, as someone who loves this sport, who covers this sport, are that breath of fresh air because it is very clear that they take every possession with a level of seriousness that excites the crowd, excites fans. So regardless of whether or not you think Philly got screwed down the stretch of game two with some of the calls or lack thereof, you can't say they wanted it more than the Knicks because they want it every single time they hit the court.
There's so much to break down there, Colin, but you glossed over a couple things early. First of all, I have to disagree that it was a blowout in game one. Now, Philly did get beat, but they competed and they showed some moments where that was a stretch where if Philly is able to put that together at home in particular, they could beat the Knicks. Now, a key, Deuce McBride has been unbelievable, so I'm glad you mentioned him. But Tyrese Maxey has been the MVP of the series in my mind. I mean, this guy is so efficient, so aggressive. The way he can get downhill as a 6'2" guard is unbelievable. Like, he is built kind of like your average college guard. You got guys built like him in the Atlantic 10, but his talent, his quickness, so unbelievable, really, over the last few days. Got to give Tyrese Maxey his flowers. But you're exactly right what you say about this Knicks identity, because in this 2024 era, we see it all too often. It's centimillionaires who are genuinely checked out. You have Ben Simmons collecting millions with no urge to play ball. And I think that throughout the NBA, you see a lot of that, whether it's selfish-minded about the money and the contracts. A lot of guys are not about the team mentality like they were in recent eras. I'd go as far to say that a chip means a heck of a lot less in 2024 than it did in the era of Michael Jordan or Magic Johnson, et cetera, because those guys were not making $100 million over 4 or 5 years. These guys are so comfortable beyond basketball. Their grandkids are set if they manage it right. And I think that provides a level of, you know, or a lack of anxiety, a lack of pressure when it comes to the result of the basketball games. And of course, the Knicks certainly are the antithesis of that. And you have to love that, particularly as the tough New York kind of what the fans embody, right? And they've given MSG a lot. So I have to love that, Colin. The only thing that worries me is if that heaters a little bit once they have to go on the road in Philadelphia. I mean, MSG, like you said, you'd never seen something like that where Dante DiVincenzo hits the three. That, I mean, what a blessing to be there. I can't imagine what it must have been like to be there. But going in Philadelphia when Maxey gets downhill late in the game, dumps it off for Embiid, that place is going to be rocking. And I'm a little worried that we've seen this, a Knicks at MSG identity that's going to be tough to get going tonight in Philadelphia.
Yeah, Colin, I love how you brought up tough and blue collar, because that's exactly how I saw the last play as well. One thing I was telling my Philadelphia roommate was, I'm letting you know right now, Josh Hart's not letting that ball get out of his hand. Julius Randle's not letting that ball get out of his hand. Jalen Brunson probably will. Tyrese Maxey probably will. There's just different kind of guys. Some guys have that dog mentality. You know, you saw it at Deuce McBride ripping a ball out of Maxey's hand, and that's what the Knicks have to do. That's their identity. We grab the ball, we rip it out, we dive on the floor, and I want to shout out Josh Hart because I think he's been the Knicks' absolutely best player throughout the series so far. 15 rebounds and 21 in game two, 13 rebounds and 22 in game one, and that's on 43 and 48 minutes. This guy's playing the whole game nonstop, first one up and down the court every time. I think he just really puts together that blue-collar thing you're talking about, and I totally agree with you, Miles, on Tyrese Maxey. I mean, sitting there as a Knicks fan, it's scary watching him come up the court because it's like a guaranteed bucket every time, no matter how you guard him. But I do agree that game one was not a blowout, but there was definitely a different feel throughout the whole game. That, Colin, I think I kind of see where you're going at there. And I think a big part of that is the rebounding and kind of Mitchell Robinson. He was very much there in the first game, very much rebounding was there. The Knicks out-rebounded them by, I think, 22 rebounds. Yeah, 22 rebounds, 14 more on the offensive end, 12 from Mitch. And then in game two, they were out-rebounded them by two, only got a little bit less than 10 from Mitch. So you see a big difference there. You saw the Sixers kind of game plan that too, getting more bodies on Mitchell Robinson. You saw him maybe getting pushed in the air a little bit, but they definitely honed in on making sure he wasn't dominating the glass. So I think if you're the Knicks in Philly, you have to get back to that. You have to get Mitchell Robinson on those boards. You need Isaiah Hartenstein on the boards because that's your MO, and you need to keep it going in Philly.
Game three, of course, tonight at 7:30. Just referring to game one, they traded quarters for the better part of the game. The Knicks won 111 to 104. It was a different game than game two, but on the glass, the Knicks with 55 rebounds, Philly with 33. This comes in a game where Jalen Brunson did not play his best basketball by any stretch of the imagination, 8 of 26 from the field. This also was a game where Joel Embiid early, not for the whole game, but early, looked efficient, ended up with 11 of 12 free throw makes, only 8 of 22 from the field. So by all accounts, this is a Knicks team that with Julius Randle would be putting a real beating on this Sixer team. And I'm quite frankly so sick of hearing about the process and about how Philly is always going to figure it out. And quite frankly, I was one of the people that liked the hire of Nick Nurse precisely because he feels like the type of head coach that's going to try and snap them out of that mentality where it's all just a continuation of the year before. He feels like the kind of coach, okay, this is a separate year, a separate game, a separate month, what have you. And part of that is Tyrese Maxey and his ability. And you knew that he was going to have to step up. He just brought home most improved player of the year honors, well-deserved for him. But from a defensive standpoint, from a grit and grime standpoint, I'm not sure he's scaring anybody in the same way that Josh Hart, quite frankly, if you're an opposing player, scares you. Because Josh Hart isn't protecting his body. It's not a LeBron, Giannis, Embiid situation where if Josh Hart's banged up, it's really affecting the whole product. Josh Hart's banged up now. I'm sure there's something there. There was some type of hand or wrist issue a little while back, and that might impact the shooting. That might impact the ball handling, but it doesn't impact the effort. It doesn't impact the fact that he's going to show up. So as far as game three is concerned, I agree with Miles in the sense of Philly's going to be a different animal because the raucous home crowd will not be on your side. But I'm less concerned about it for this Knicks team because it seems as though the entire NBA can't stand them. I mean, what, 2-3 days ago, there was this athletic poll about how Tom Thibodeau is the coach that opposing players would least like to play for, or players in general wouldn't want to play for. And they all came to his defense. Dante DiVincenzo, Josh Hart, and, you know, they would run through a wall for Tom Thibodeau. And I don't really subscribe to the idea that the minutes police should be on him at every minute because of the type of team he has. Now, if he has a KD or Giannis, we're having a different conversation, but he doesn't. What he does have is a Jalen Brunson, who's vastly underperformed for these first two games. So I want to get your guys' thoughts on this for game three. Game one, 8 of 26 from the field. Game two, 8 of 29 from the field. He's due to figure something out. Now, Philly's been blitzing him 10 ways to Sunday. They've done a good job of neutralizing him. If he gets going in any capacity, from an efficiency standpoint, this thing's over. This thing's over in four or five. If Brunson puts up a good game in game three, it's done in game four. Because at that point, with Embiid crying in the towel, with everyone being concerned about everything but the actual on-court play, it's over.
Well, to me, Colin, I mean, look, 16 for 55 in two games out of Jalen Brunson. He proved a lot of haters right, unfortunately. And it's been an ugly stretch. It's been tough to watch. And I think, you know, he hasn't looked like that. We talked about the A1 conversation with the head coach of the Aces, Becky Hammon, and all that. He hasn't looked like an A1 superstar. And there's been moments in these first two games when Philly's on their runs where I'm thinking, gosh, what if we just had Julius Randle out there? And the fact of the matter is the play has been so lackluster for Brunson that you're thinking about, oh, who could we get some assistance from? And I do think, you know, it's fair to say if Brunson gets going in game three, the series is going to be over real quick. But that's easier said than done. This is in Philadelphia. Philadelphia's plan has worked perfectly. Blitz, Brunson, and it's worked. And I'm assuming that that's going to be the same kind of thing where Brunson's going to face heavy pressure today in Philadelphia. it's going to be an even tougher combination of factors. Attention from Philly's defense in Philadelphia, loud Philly arena. Is Brunson going to step up and be the guy he hasn't been over the first two games? I don't believe so. There's nothing that he's shown me in the first two games that says that he's going to turn around and give us that performance efficiency on the road. I mean, 16 of 55 for a tier one superstar is about as heinous as it
just
gets. And
a
I know
massive hater today. Jeez.
I'm a Philly guy today is what I am.
Oh my gosh. Get out of here.
After the first two games, there's nothing that tells me this is going to be a bounce back day. Now, obviously I'm alone on this.
I think it's coming. I think it's brewing, it's cooking, and this Jalen Brunson game is coming. And it's tonight or it's tomorrow night. I'm with you, Colin. And for me, it's the fact that he's getting the shot
game
he wants. What'd you say, Miles?
I could see game four.
Yeah. It's one of these games. I'm not going to say tonight. It could be four. But it's coming before this Philly series ends. And it's because they're not stopping him from getting the shot he wants, in my opinion. He's just not making the shot. And I think Jalen Brunson, being the player he is, being the guy who puts in the hours in the gym that we know he does with his dad, Rick Brunson, those shots are going to fall. I see him taking shots he makes 9 times out of 10 throughout the regular season, that patient layup. He lets the defender jump over him. The little footwork, the middies are going. It's just not falling. They're not stopping him from getting a good shot. He's getting the shot he wants every time. It's just rattling around the rim. It's just not going in. So I think with him playing the way he wants to, eventually he's going to execute, and it's going to come. And if it comes tonight, I'm with both of you. Series is over.
Because at that point, if you're Philadelphia, what more can you do? You go down 3-0 at home, and all the haters at that point, including Miles, have to start to wonder if the Knicks are better than they're giving them credit for. The last thing I'll say on the Knicks and on the Brunson front is that I had this conversation yesterday with my co-beat reporter, Chris Persiani, and we often call about the state of the team. And yesterday, we spoke about the shots that Brunson was taking, to Evan's point. There was some number that he had for me that an abundance of those shots were self-created in the sense that they were coming off the dribble. They were not coming directly from a pass or a spot-up opportunity. When you look at it through that lens, to me, it almost feels like someone like a DiVincenzo, someone even like a Hartenstein in that stretch four that they've asked him to play at times this year, is going to have to step up and try to find Brunson specifically with some spot up opportunities early to get him going so that when he has to create off the dribble, perhaps later in the game, he feels more comfortable doing so. I think Jalen Brunson is going to figure it out in this series. I'm banking on it being game three. I would go so far as saying I'm confident that it will be in game three. I actually wrote an article recently saying if he steps up this playoff run, he changes his NBA image forever. Remember, this is a Knicks team that's without Julius Randle, and Knicks fans give Julius Randle a lot of unnecessary flack. I'm a vehement Julius Randle defender. You can't say Brunson's not a superstar if he steps up through the blitzes that Philly is sending on him, that Indiana or Milwaukee will send at him, and certainly that Boston will send at him if Boston gets that far, and we'll have that conversation. If he's able to withstand all that, we're having a different conversation about Jalen Brunson altogether, and one that he'll deserve to be a part of at that time. But a lot remains to be seen tonight at 7:30. The Knicks will be playing the Sixers in Philly. It's the cheesesteak versus the bacon, egg, and cheese. We'll see how it goes down south. But we do have some Brooklyn Nets news. Miles, I know it's been a particularly hard year of watching the Nets play basketball, but it looks as if they're trying to turn over a new leaf, trying to find a clean slate. They hired Jordy Fernandez as their next head coach. I really like this pick for them. He was a former assistant coach of the Sacramento Kings. He was a part of a team that was very successful in Sacramento from an offensive standpoint. This was a Nets team that struggled offensively last year, and partially that was due to personnel, also due to coaching. But all things considered, I like the hire.
Yeah, Colin, I like the hire as well. I think that this was their guy. You know, I mean, for the last few weeks, kind of was the writing was on the wall. Kevin Ollie was not being reconsidered to, you know, have the interim tag removed, and Fernandez was their guy. And I mean, Fernandez was he's kind of a hot name. I feel like if the Nets weren't going to give him a head coaching job, he was going to get a head coaching job elsewhere. It was kind of just trending in that direction. He was, you know, Mike Brown's guy. I forget which country, but one of the African squads. He was the national team head assistant under Mike Brown. And then when he came over, he got the head coach job as the team is with Canada. So, you know, he has that head coaching experience. He is kind of a hot name in the business. But to me, Colin, it's still tough because of the personnel issues. I mean, you take a look at Sean Marks is still being entrusted as the guy to lead this organization by, you know, Joe Tsai. And Joe Tsai has proven that he's a relatively apathetic owner. Results don't seem to be all that important. And that's just the fact of the matter. The CBA is such what Joe Tsai as an owner can sit back and collect checks. And the attitude that he has kind of employed throughout his tenure is really kind of one that says he doesn't care all that much. He's got Sean Marks in a spot where Sean Marks has done nothing but underperform over 7 years. And then he's still supposed to sit back and be the GM. And now I like the pick of Fernandez, but Colin, what worries me is, what is Fernandez to do? I mean, this is a group that lacked A1 talent, lacked kind of that B level talent as well outside of Bridges, and Bridges seemed checked out in the second, you know, when they had been eliminated. I mean, it's hard to speak about the Brooklyn Nets positively right now, even with this new hire.
It's definitely hard to speak positively, especially when this is your sixth head coach since the 2019 season, including interim guys. I mean, you need a guy that's going to stay there for more than half a year if you're the Brooklyn Nets. That's step one. And I love what you're saying about the players, Miles, because I totally agree. It's like, what is Fernandez supposed to shoot for? 500 with these players he has? But I do like a quote that he said he really likes the Nets, quote-unquote, flexibility, resources, and a recipe for success. Now, I like how he didn't say players, because they don't have the players to succeed, but they do have the resources this year, freeing up a lot of cap space, I believe, that they did not have the year before. So I think this is the year, the offseason, that they're kind of, we're really hoping to get to with an okay, you know, with Bridges, with Cam Thomas, with Nick Claxton, with a little bit of a foundation, so they can really start to move things around, because I think you really need to if you're the Nets. You can't just sit around 500 ever since the big three didn't work. It's just doesn't work in New York, especially. It's not good for the fan base or anything. And I also read that they really like Nick Claxton. They're really hoping to build around him specifically. Direct quote from Marks. There's no doubt about that. We hope he's a Net for a very long time. Hope to continue to build around him and so forth. Think he's scratched the surface of who he could end up being one day. I don't know about all that. I don't know if he's an A1 player. So I think maybe if you have to move Bridges, I don't think that's the biggest deals. He's not an A1 player. Bridges is not going to bring your team past the play-in by himself. So if you're the Nets, good hire, in my opinion, but you still got work to do.
I know a team one borough over that would love to have Mikal Bridges on their squad, but we'll have to see if Nick Claxton remains a Net. I certainly think it would be wise for the Nets to keep him. Otherwise, then you're banking on De'Ron Sharpe or Noah Clowney really growing into something. And I've loved what I've seen so far from Noah Clowney. There's certain things that I shake my head at. The ability to finish at the rim is inconsistent. The jump shot is good, but not where you want it to be yet. Ultimately, though, what intrigues me the most about Coach Jordy is going to be the international pull that he's going to have. Jordy Fernandez is someone that has been around the game of basketball. I won't even just say the NBA circuit. He coached Team Canada. He coached all these different places. He's been around. And as the game goes more and more towards this international phenomenon where you're seeing a Giannis, a Luka Doncic, people of that sort, having someone like Jordy Fernandez that has been to the corners of the earth with this game could be so helpful, because you don't know who's going to slip through the cracks. Did anyone really know that Domantas Sabonis was going to be Domantas Sabonis initially? Perhaps there was someone that did. I certainly didn't. I would imagine a lot of GMs didn't know that. Jordy Fernandez gives the Nets a certain edge that they might not currently have with Sean Marks, with Joe Tsai, especially if, like Miles was saying, Tsai is truly apathetic to this team and content with mediocrity. Jordy Fernandez could be the guy to say, hey, listen, you know, there's this country, blah, 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 and there's this guy that's been playing really well, and suddenly you have a 20-point per game guy, which could be what the Nets need. And you look at how the game's going, could be massively useful. So hopefully some better times ahead for the Brooklyn Nets. We are going to swing back towards playoff action, though, because it is springtime. You have to concentrate on that section of the association of this game we love. And last night, the Boston Celtics, by all accounts, wet the bed. It was bad. And I mean bad. This was terrible. Losing to the Miami Heat 111 to 101. Miami hit a franchise record 23 three-pointers. I'm not even concerned about the three-pointers. Well, that's not true. I am concerned about the three-pointers. I'm more concerned about how they got the three-pointers because Tyler Hero, a shooter, one of the better shooters in the NBA, arguably one of the best three-point shooters in the NBA, found a way to rack up 14 assists. 24 points, 14 assists, 7 of 13 from the field, 6 of 11 from range. This is not a guy that facilitates. He's a shoot-first player. You literally tell him, stand on the perimeter, wait for the ball, shoot it. If you can create off the dribble, by all means, go ahead and do that. He's not someone you say, run the offense and find the open man. If Tyler Hero can do something akin to what he did in game two, this is dicey because I'm not sure last night if Boston had an answer for it. And I've been saying this for months and months, and nobody believed me. This is where you miss Marcus Smart because Marcus Smart, unlike Jrue Holiday, has a little psycho in him. Jrue Holiday, probably the best perimeter guy in the NBA. Marcus Smart, where he lacks in talent, makes up for it with intensity. It's a little bit of that Josh Hart thing where it's just like, I don't care if I got to jump on the court 5 out of 6 possessions. We're going to get it done. And now you're going to miss that because if Miami made an adjustment to even make this thing close, the series is going to go longer than it has to. And on top of that, Kristaps Porzingis was god awful last night. I mean, hell, Miles, Evan, we could have shot better in this game. Kristaps Porzingis, 1 for 9 from the field, 0 of 4 from 3-point land. Stephen A. on First Take today said something to the effect of, "You're 7 foot whatever. How are you going 1 from 9 from the field?" And
Taking it hard.
I have to agree with him on this one because you need Kristaps Porzingis to at least give you 15 to 20 a night, and 1 of 9 ain't cutting it for a Celtics team that ran through the regular season and now the intensity went out the door in game two.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that gotta shock you if you're a Boston Celtics fan. First of all, the whole kind of like baseball theme of you can dominate the regular season, then it goes out the window. I mean, if you're the Miami Heat team that's without Jimmy Butler and they embarrassed the Boston Celtics yesterday, I mean, there were times, right, where Hero was getting those open looks and you really started to question whether if Boston had the defensive intensity to hang in this series. But Colin, I think that is a one-off, if you will. I think that the Boston Celtics will have enough to certainly make it past the Miami Heat. But what has to loom large now is they don't have what it takes defensively to hang with the top dogs come 2 series from now or 3 series from now. Let's say they do push through the East and they have to face a Denver, maybe, et cetera. Obviously, you saw some traction on Twitter comparing those two last night, but it does seem like, you know, the defensive effort might be lacking. And when you have this team that gets sort of complacent, I think a little bit, you dominate the regular season. Obviously, we saw it with the Warriors, where you have the historic clip throughout the regular season. You follow the LeBron-led Cavs. I don't think that this is that extreme of a situation where the Celtics put on that type of a display where that level of complacency comes into play. But nevertheless, you don't like the trend of having to coast into the postseason. I think that doesn't set you up for first round success. And obviously, playing one of the least talented teams in this playoffs, a Jimmy Butler-less Heat team, it has to scare you if you're a Celtics fan. I don't think it comes into play this series, but down the stretch, I don't think they are who we thought they are.
I think I'm for sure less worried about the Celtics than you guys. I think this is a fluke game. For sure. I think the Celtics get it done in five. And the reason I think this is the Heat shot 54% from three, and they made the most three-pointers in playoff history. That's not going to happen any other game of the series. So I think in that sense, it's a little bit fluky. I think it was a great game plan by Spoelstra to attempt that many threes because he kind of realized we need that to win. We're going to need to outscore them. I do agree that the defensive issues showed up. But Colin, I think Tyler Hero is a better player than you're giving him a little bit of credit for here, especially when Jimmy Butler doesn't play. You see Tyler Hero, even in the regular season, in previous playoff games without Butler, take over that role. And he plays better in the playoffs than he does in the regular season every season there that he's able to play in the playoffs. I know he's been injured before, but the Celtics, I'd say as long as you don't let the Heat get two, because of what that can do to a team psychologically, physically, you're playing more games, you're getting beat up a little bit more. It just drowns the energy that you have from that regular season. I don't think they're going to let them get two, but if they do, I'm going to start agreeing with you guys on this problem, this domino effect. For now, I'm seeing this as one fluke game in a series that they're going to take in five. They're just not going to sweep them because Spoelstra's that good and he can win a game. I saw it last year as a Knicks fan. Gabe Vincent, Caleb Martin, and Max Strus destroyed my team, and it was because Eric Spoelstra is that good.
Make no mistake, I still think the Celtics are going to win this series ultimately, but there is kind of a boogeyman effect here, even without Jimmy Butler, who's going to be out for the duration of the playoffs, it seems. Where if you're Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown, it's in the back of your mind that the Heat have sent you packing two of the last 4 years ballpark. They lost last year. They beat him in 22. But even before that, the Celtics and Heat rivalry runs deep. It's been a thing. Even when LeBron was on the Heat and it was Bron versus the older versions of Pierce, KG, Rondo, Allen, that crew, it's there. There's that boogeyman effect here that I don't know if is getting enough attention, where if the Heat win another game, Evan, exactly like what you were saying, mentally, it gets really dicey at that point, and the Celtics are going to need to find a way to regroup after game two, because it's almost worse if they lost that game at home. That's one of the best home court advantages in basketball. It's Boston, it's Philly, it's New York. I'd even put Lakers crowd in there when the Lakers are jumping. So to lose a game at home in the playoffs, not what you're looking for a team that certainly has designs on winning a championship. We're running out of time here, but I do want to swing around and just get some other thoughts because we don't have time to go through every series. But if there's anything that stuck out during the playoffs, now would be the time to dig into that a little bit. Evan, what do you got for us?
I think the T-Wolves are a better team than a lot of people gave them credit for coming in. I think they're going to beat the Suns. I think they're a more complete team. I know they're up in the series right now, but they weren't even playing their best basketball, and they were working the Suns. The T-Wolves shot 28% from three in game two and won that game by 12 points. They're just so much more of a complete team. This is a little bit of Suns hate as well, but because the Suns just have a strictly ISO offense with no bench, and a bunch of guys who really aren't that poised to play defense, besides not even being able to play that good of defense. Where on the other side, you got the T-Wolves. They have a complete team. They have defenders. Jaden McDaniels, Anthony Edwards is a good defender as well. He's a 1A guy for sure. Not that the Suns don't have that, but the T-Wolves do. They got Rudy Gobert manning the paint, a guy who's won Defensive Player of the Year how many times? So I think the T-Wolves, and I really like the energy that Ant gives them. It's somewhat to me kind of the energy you saw Juan Soto bring to the Yankees, kind of this, we don't care, we're here to be electric, we're here to take down the big dogs, you know, we want to be the big dogs. I think the T-Wolves are going to make some noise.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right there with you. Actually, I wanted to bring up Anthony Edwards and the Minnesota Timberwolves as well, because Anthony Edwards didn't play nearly his best basketball in game two and they still dominated that. I love the home court in Minnesota. I think that, you know, you go up 2-0 on the Suns at home, you maintain home court advantage. You basically eliminated Phoenix right there, because it's going to be so difficult for the Suns to come back, take one on the road. And I think that moving into rounds two and three, you have to consider that the Minnesota Timberwolves have a legitimate home court advantage. And if Anthony Edwards is on, they have arguably the best player in this playoffs, if he's on and he's like that. Now, he was so far from that. Jaden McDaniels had a solid game. Naz Reid was terrible. Naz Reid, the sixth man of the year, was terrible, and they still find a way. I mean, it really feels like the ceiling for the Timberwolves. I mean, Cat, foul trouble. He had three fouls in the first quarter, had to sit the entire second. If it felt like everything went wrong for the Timberwolves and they still won handily, it does seem like if there's a team that seems to have a rising ceiling, I thought kind of going into this playoffs, it might be the Dallas Mavericks. It's not. It is the Minnesota Timberwolves. They have a chance to make a run in the West.
Man, that was quick. That series is only at 1-1. The Mavericks still have a fighter's chance, I'd say. The Clippers could blow up at any given moment. I think you're being too hard on the poor Mavericks there.
That game one was all I needed to see.
Well, I'm glad you guys addressed the Western Conference because I have two things from the East that I wanted to touch on briefly. That Pacers-Bucks series is very close because Milwaukee has done this meltdown thing before, especially without Giannis. And I don't know if Giannis is going to play in game three or game four, but if he doesn't come back, that series has been a mess. Indiana can't play defense, but if they got hot shooting the ball, it might not make a difference. In which case, what a wonky bracket that would be in the East if Indiana is able to get past Milwaukee. And also to that point of just looking at the Eastern Conference and kind of scratching your head, I wonder what ramifications that has for a Boston, a New York, or even a Miami. Because if Miami sees that Indiana advances, they have to be thinking in the back of their mind, even without Jimmy momentarily, there's a world where perhaps way down the stretch towards the NBA Finals time, if you want a blue sky, he could be back. So it just changes mindsets at that point. Even Indiana pushing Milwaukee changes how you think about these series. And one thing on the West here, Jamal Murray, big shot in game two to win it for the Denver Nuggets. Of course, they're the darlings of the NBA right now. Many have them repeating going back to back. I do not. However, they've made LA look pretty bad late in the game, but LA has competed for the entire first three and a half quarters of games one and two. I would not be surprised if LA won game three. And then game four, if the Lakers at home muster up one more win, then you're talking about something completely different. And again, that doesn't change the fact that Denver's a much better team. That doesn't change the fact that they have Nikola Jokic, arguably one of the best players in the world, probably the best player in the world at this time. But Lakers have LeBron, and they have Anthony Davis, who every once in a while gets pissed off enough to have a great game because he's sick and tired of hearing people say he's made of porcelain.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the Lakers are the best matchup for the Nuggets for sure. And because Anthony Davis is as good as he is in his prime, the problem is his consistency, like you said, which Nikola Jokic, you know, is bringing every game. That guy's the best player in the world. In my opinion, he deserves the LeBron treatment where you throw him in the MVP talk every year because he probably is the best player every year. So I don't think the Lakers take two at home. I think the Nuggets go up 3-1. Just because of, like you said, their ability to close out games that we didn't see from the Lakers. We know the Lakers have guys that have won rings recently, but the Nuggets won one more recently with almost the exact same team. So they just seem like they're going through the motions when they're winning a playoff game in the fourth quarter, and it's a crazy thing. They seem like they expected to do that. They expect to win, you know, and it's not just Jamal Murray, and it's not just Nikola Jokic. It's Michael Porter Jr. It's Aaron Gordon. And I think they have way more of a complete team than the Lakers. But I completely agree. If there's a team that I think can knock them off, it is the Lakers show. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, Denver is a complete team, as complete as it really gets. I have a hot take for you guys. I actually think, given that late game prowess of Denver, I think they take it in four. I think that both games are close, 3 and 4. I think they take it in four. And you know what else happens after they take it in four? Darvin Ham is canned. That's my prediction, but we'll see.
A lot of basketball left to be played this spring. I know I'm excited about it. I know you guys are excited about it as well. It's been a blast breaking it down with you. Hopefully we get to do this again real soon. That's going to do it for this edition of Pick and Pod. For Evan Harkin and Miles Grossman, I'm Colin Lochran saying so long.